You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin has made efforts to boost broadband access to more parts of the state, but it's still lagging behind much of the country. We'll get the latest in the state and around the nation on bringing high-speed internet access to everyone who wants it. Now, a group of Republican state lawmakers are proposing an amendment to the state constitution that would extend civil rights to the unborn. The move is controversial, with even some groups opposed to abortion opposed to it. And it has a long road to becoming a constitutional amendment. It would have to pass the state legislature twice and then win approval in a statewide referendum. Andre Jacques is a Republican state senator representing Wisconsin's first state Senate district, which covers six counties, including Door, Kewaunee, and parts of Calumet County. He's one of the co-sponsors of the proposed amendment. Senator Jacques, welcome back to the show.
Oh, good afternoon, Rob. Great to be back on the program.
Well, can you walk us through, on a technical level, what this amendment would change?
Sure. So basically, it just removes some archaic language in the state constitution by removing the word born as a requirement to access the inalienable rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. It's the sort of thing that we have unfortunately seen with state Supreme Courts in Kansas and Iowa, where they have basically had activist majorities on those courts create a constitutional right to abortion independent of Roe versus Wade, which has struck down pro-life laws on the books in those states in recent years. And, of course, now their legislatures are scrambling to similarly put something into the state constitution to prohibit that. We have the ability to be proactive, and we've known this for some time in Wisconsin, that there is language that goes back to when our constitution was written. Of course, going back to our very first criminal code, abortion has been illegal. But looking at an activist Supreme Court, we have a vulnerability that would certainly be used at the point that you would have an activist liberal majority on the state Supreme Court that would strike down our existing pro-life laws on the books, including Statute 940-04, which is basically a ban on abortion that would go back into effect if Roe versus Wade were overturned at the federal level. But regardless, this is going to protect our existing pro-life laws on the books, not just 940-04.
So if Roe versus Wade were struck down and this constitutional amendment were passed, would the effect be then that abortion would be illegal in Wisconsin?
Correct. Well, and this basically makes very clear, and there have been attempts legislatively before by Democrats to remove our pro-life law in the books at 940-04. They have failed, and there have been pro-life Democrats that have been key in stopping that when you have had Democrat majorities in the state legislature. But basically, this makes very clear that there is not going to be judicial activism. It basically says that the legislature is going to be deferred to in terms of any prohibition of conduct in regard to unborn persons and protecting them.
Now, another hypothetical, if the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, but this amendment doesn't pass, so the Constitution of Wisconsin stays as it is, wouldn't that state law outlawing abortion still take effect?
It would take effect. The question is, how quickly would it be challenged? And obviously, it would be challenged relatively quickly, especially if you had folks who politically were motivated to do so. So certainly, as you see state Supreme Court races that take on a more partisan tone, it never gets too far of a swing in terms of left and right, where it could only be a couple state Supreme Court races and we're back in a position where liberals on the court would be able to redefine and basically create state law. This is trying to prevent a judicial end around the legislative branch.
Now, before we get into concerns raised on both sides of the debate about this proposal, I wanted to ask, this is an issue you're passionate about. Can you talk a little bit about how your views on abortion, and this is a key part of your action as a state legislator, how that came to be?
Well, I think I've always been strongly pro-life. I've always sought to prevent any sort of a state or taxpayer subsidy for abortion providers. I think that it's just something fundamentally that I believe in out of principle, and something that my district is very strongly supported. And, there's the, really just a fundamental belief that at the point that it is a new human person created, they have rights as well. And we cannot allow for any sort of action to kill another person.
Talking to State Senator Andre Jacques from Wisconsin's 1st District about a constitutional amendment that would remove the word born in defining civil rights for people. Effectively, if Roe versus Wade were overturned by the Supreme Court, helping to make and keep abortion illegal in Wisconsin. Now, some objections kind of across the board. One major anti-abortion or pro-life group in this state, Wisconsin Right to Life, is opposed to this change. They have concerns that you would actually be adding some gray area that they wouldn't want to see. What do you say to that concern?
Well, you know, their concern over time has morphed from, I know they've talked about, well, it's risky. Certainly we've seen the risk that exists from doing nothing because Iowa and Kansas have been stripped of their pro-life protections. I don't think this is risky at all. I think it's pretty clear that at some point or another, we're going to need to cross this bridge. Now, they might see that as further off because there's currently not a liberal majority on the state Supreme Court. But, you know, one of the other concerns that they've raised previously would be the cost of educating voters in a state constitutional referendum. And honestly, to me, that's kind of immaterial to the policy that we need to put in place. I'm certainly happy to put this before the voters and trust their judgment. So, you know, I'm very proud to have the support of not only my many co-authors on this, including a majority of Republicans on both of the committees that it was referred to. Certainly Representative Janelle Branchin, Representative Joe Sanfilippo have been key supporters in this effort. But also, of course, Pro-Life Wisconsin, Wisconsin Family Action, two of the three largest pro-life organizations in the state. And, you know, given the fact that we've seen such strident opposition from the pro-abortion activist groups in the state of Wisconsin, should tell you that we're on the right track.
Sarah Finger from the Wisconsin Alliance for Women's Health has said this amendment, quote, scares us so much because as soon as you recognize the rights of that fertilized egg, which most of us don't know is inside of us, then you put us up for criminal penalty if we smoke a cigarette, if we take birth control, if we go rock climbing, if we take chemotherapy because we have cancer. And there have been cases in other states where mothers have been prosecuted under fetal personhood laws for their personal health behaviors. What do you think about those concerns?
Well, obviously, it's hyperbole to the greatest extent. It's ridiculous. These are the same folks that have tried to muddy the waters previously by not only talking about things like birth control, but that somehow there would be investigations for miscarriages or falsely claiming that somehow when you have legitimate medical procedure that's performed in the result of a miscarriage, which might medically be known as a spontaneous abortion, but clearly has never been known as an abortion under state law, and we have definitions that are very clear to make that evidence. So really, it's just more of the hyperbole that I've come to expect from the pro-abortion left.
So there wouldn't be any penalty for a woman engaging in health behaviors that could endanger the fertilized egg, as Sarah Finger said. Though that has happened in other states, you're sure that wouldn't happen here?
Well, in Wisconsin, we already have certain things in place to, you know, in the case where there is clearly an intent to harm a child. I mean, again, this is really right along the same lines of our fetal homicide laws. But the language of the amendment itself makes very clear in Section 2 that the legislature may define by law the scope of protections afforded by this section to unborn persons. Any prohibition of conduct with regard to unborn persons shall be prescribed by the legislature by law. This is a constitutional amendment. It's not making any changes whatsoever to state law. So to say that somehow this constitutional amendment in and of itself is going to do anything that is going to cause any additional problems beyond whatever we're already dealing with is just absurd. Because, again, what we're doing with this constitutional amendment is protecting the existing laws that we have, not going into any of these new areas that are supposedly being thrown out there as boogeymen by Sarah Finger.
And finally, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has said he doesn't think the Assembly will act on this session. Do you have hopes that you can change his mind on that?
Well, you know, I'm very pleased that we had a very good public hearing on this. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to have the same in the state Senate, potentially advance it out of committee there. But outside of that, I mean, this is a conversation that is very important to the state of Wisconsin. And, you know, certainly this is not an issue that is currently in front of us just because we don't have an activist state Supreme Court right now that is looking to reverse our protections, but that may not be the case in the future. And I'm hopeful that, you know, as we continue to have discussions with Wisconsin Right to Life and others, that they will see the wisdom in making sure that we don't repeat the mistakes of Iowa and Kansas by not having very clear language within our state constitution.
Senator Jacques, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's State Senator Andre Jacques, Republican who represents Wisconsin's 1st State Senate District, which includes Kewaunee, Door, and parts of Calumet County. He was with us today to talk about his proposed amendment to the state constitution. Coming up, there's a new app that highlights Black-owned businesses, events, and cultural sites in Milwaukee. We'll talk with one of the founders about why he says it's important to support the city's African-American community and economy. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest came up with a new way to promote Black entrepreneurs in Milwaukee. We found out how he made his new app. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a look into how Wisconsin became the Badger State.
We recently received a listener question in the Wisconsin mailbag. Michael from Dane County asked, why is the badger Wisconsin state animal? WPR's John K. Wilson went digging to find out more.
Wisconsin is the badger state. It's on the flag, it's the mascot of the state's biggest university, and back in 1957, lawmakers put the badger into state law as Wisconsin's official animal. But why? Badgers live in plenty of states, and they're pretty rare here. It's not like you see them running around willy-nilly like squirrels. To get some answers, I figured why not start by going straight to the source. Bucky, pretty common name for badgers, I guess, is the resident education badger at Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison. He goes on field trips and teaches kids about nature, so maybe he'd have something to tell me. On a recent morning, I talked with him in his enclosure while he was eating a hard-boiled egg. Hi, Bucky. John K. Wilson with WPR. Can I ask you a few questions? Do you know why the badger is Wisconsin's state animal? Any idea why you're on the state flag? I've seen this type before. Cute, but not a talker. Clearly, I needed someone with some more specialized knowledge.
My name is Jim Leary, and I'm a retired faculty at UW-Madison in Folklore and Scandinavian Studies.
Leary studies the history and culture of Midwestern people. He said the whole Wisconsin badger thing comes down to
lead mining in the late 1820s and into the 1830s and beyond in the southwest part of the state.
Yeah, lead mining.
In lead mining, there were little holes that people started to dig in and sometimes abandon, and they were called, you know, they were sometimes called badger holes. But the prevailing story is that the early settlers actually lived in these holes, and that's where the name came from.
Turns out, though, that probably never happened. Leary says historians can't find any reliable evidence that miners actually lived in their badger holes. But either way, the name stuck. So, to boil it down, the badger is Wisconsin's state animal because 200 years ago, people here went digging for lead. And actual badgers also dig holes?
He is a great digger. He's got those really long front claws that are fantastic at digging burrows really quickly.
Back at the zoo, curator Jess Thompson had plenty of other good facts about real badgers like Bucky and his cousins in the wild.
There are a couple different types of badgers. There are badgers that live in Europe, European badgers. There's obviously the honey badger that many people know about in Africa. And there are some badgers that live in Asia. And most of those species are much more social. But our North American badgers are really solitary.
Thompson says badgers are ferocious hunters.
They also have jaws that are really hard to dislocate because of the way that they're attached in their skull. So because of that, they're able to attach really firmly onto their prey.
But aside from hunting prowess and a shared history of digging, is there something about badgers that makes them a good symbol for Wisconsin?
Definitely. Yeah, these guys are so resourceful, and they're known for being tough and being able to make it through a lot of different circumstances. So a lot of great qualities.
John K. Wilson is a digital editor at WPR and is the co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. And this story came to us from a listener question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, for years, our next guest says Milwaukee was missing an app to highlight black businesses in the city. And now he's taken steps to fix that problem. Rick Banks and one of his childhood friends came up with an app that promotes not only African-American-owned businesses, but also cultural sites, neighborhoods, events, and more. It's called MKE Black, and it was rolled out last week. Rick Banks is the political director for Black Leaders Organizing for Communities and co-founder of MKE Black. Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Well, how does this app work, Rick?
Well, you just you download it. Right now it's available on the Google Play Store, coming soon, very soon to Apple, but you just download it, and as soon as you open it, it gives you a couple different categories from food and drink, attractions, resources, news and social media sites, all Black-owned businesses or resources that are available to people in the community to help people, you know where these locations are.
Where did you get the idea to have an app like this?
Well, I really thought about it as I was thinking about, economic development and community organizing, as that's my background, and thinking about, how we can help support black businesses and things like that. And I thought there really wasn't, a centralized location to find out where these kinds of businesses were. So I'm like, somebody should create an app. And then I didn't have the technical skills to do it at the time when I first thought about it. So I kind of put the idea on a shelf for a while. And then my friend reached out to me. He had the same idea. And I'm like, let's do it. And so we just went about creating it.
Yeah, I understand you priced out hiring somebody else to do it, and turns out apps don't come cheap if you don't do them yourself.
Yeah, they're not cheap. But my friend Paul, who's the co-founder, he found this platform called Buildfire that was only $60 a month, and you didn't have to know how to code or anything like that. It was basically that kind of a click and drag kind of thing, and he made it work. For a lot cheaper than what a professional coder would have cost us.
Why is it important to have these resources and then to support Black-owned and Black-run ventures in the Milwaukee area?
Well, as you know, we live in one of the most segregated counties or cities in the country. Racial inequality and racial inequity is a huge thing in all over the country, but especially here in Milwaukee. And if we're talking about fixing those inequities, one of the best ways to do that is to put your money where your mouth is and support Black-owned businesses. Those are institutions that are helping to build wealth in Black communities, and no community can really thrive without successful small businesses. And so I think it's important that people, all people really show support to these businesses, because without, a solid customer base, none of them will thrive.
Talking to Rick Banks, political director for Black Leaders Organizing for Communities and co-creator of the new app we're talking about, MKE Black, aimed at promoting Black-owned businesses in the Milwaukee area. Rick, I think a lot of us have asked the question, why isn't there blank available in our community? But most of us don't actually do it. What made you the one to say, okay, you and your partner here, okay, we're the ones to solve this problem?
I think, one, we had we just had the synergy at the time, and we had, some ideas. We're both really dedicated to, showing black culture and black events and supporting the community. Myself, my day job is working to improve quality of life in black communities. Paul's actually the author of a book about black architects. So for us, it was very important to actually, make something happen. And when we figured out that we had the tools to make it happen, why not let it be us? Even since we launched the app, people have come up to us like, oh, I had this idea as well, but nobody has been able to really make it happen. And so we found the right tools, we had the right team, and we made it happen.
So what's your goal for what's going to come out of MKE Black?
Yeah, we are working together we want to form the organization as a nonprofit, and so we hope to get donations and things like that we can use to support small businesses through either technical assistance or marketing grants or something like that. Also working to put together some events where we can showcase different black-owned businesses, kind of like a flash mob type thing. We organize the community to support one business at a time kind of thing. And who knows what else? The original idea creation around the app was really around a different idea I had. But in order for that idea to work, I had to have some way to know where all the businesses were. So I'm hoping to still be able to move forward with that idea very soon. So the opportunities are endless up there.
What kind of variety have you discovered of Black-owned businesses in Milwaukee?
There's some of everything. You know, there are restaurants and shopping places, of course. There's also media companies and podcasts and, you know, plumbers and electricians and doctors and lawyers and real estate agents. Just any profession you can think of, there's a Black-owned business in Milwaukee for it.
And are you hoping maybe this gets attention? Oh, I don't know if there's a major political committee group meeting in Milwaukee in the near future, or hoping they get wind of this?
Of course. Yeah, we've had a very brief conversation with some of the folks connected to the DNC. We've got to set up some longer conversations. That was a big part of our goal as well, was, you know, unfortunately for a lot of tourist places, when you see the magazines and things showcasing what they're to do in Milwaukee, they leave out the north side and, you know, the Hispanic south side. And so we really wanted there to be an option for people to know that there's more to Milwaukee than just east side, downtown, and Bayview. But there's lots of great restaurants and shopping places on the far northwest side. And we're hoping to really connect with the DNC and get this app in the hands of the 50,000 plus people that are coming to Milwaukee.
Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
Rick Banks is political director for Black Leaders Organizing for Communities. We talked to them about the new app he co-founded called MKE Black. It highlights Black-owned businesses in Milwaukee, neighborhood history, an events calendar, and other info. You can learn more at mkeblack.com. Coming up, Wisconsin has a record amount of money to support broadband expansion across the state this year, but still the funds will not be enough to meet the demand. We'll talk about the obstacles of getting broadband, especially to rural parts of the state. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent welcomes a personal finance expert with advice for your money management and answers to your questions. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, according to the FCC's most recent broadband deployment report, roughly 28% of Wisconsin's rural population still lacks access to broadband internet. That's a significant improvement to the 43% in need just a couple years ago, but there's still improvement to be made. And even when the access is there, the quality, affordability, and reliability of the provider is still an open question. Wisconsin will provide a record amount of money, $24 million, for increasing broadband access this year, but the Wisconsin Broadband Office says that's still not enough to match the amount of requests they're getting from schools, residents, and businesses around the state. Jaron McCollum is the state broadband director within the Division of Digital Access, Consumer, and Environmental Affairs at the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin. In his role, he provides leadership in encouraging coordination between partners to promote greater availability, adoption, and affordability of broadband around the state. Jaron, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate you having me.
Well, can you tell us about this $24 million Wisconsin is providing? How does that work?
Yes, so we were very fortunate to see a pretty significant increase in funding for our broadband expansion grant program, and that $24 million is available to eligible entities in eligible unserved and underserved areas of the state. And that is a competitive grant program that provides reimbursement for equipment and construction expenses incurred to extend or improve broadband telecommunication service in underserved areas of the state.
Why does this need state help? Why isn't private business able to do this?
Well, really, I think it comes down to funding and money in the business case. So we're very fortunate. We've got a great number of quality providers in our state that have done a good job of expanding broadband infrastructure in areas where it makes reasonable sense and business sense, and there's a return on investment to expand that infrastructure, but due to population density and other factors, there are a number of areas of the state where the business case may just not be there. And that's where our grant program can really step in and provide some additional incentive for those providers to connect those unserved folks in our state.
Are we mainly talking about rural Wisconsin?
I think that's a fair statement. I think generally speaking that rural Wisconsin is primarily affected by this issue, but there are certainly some urban and suburban areas that are also affected.
Some people look at this and think, okay, you know, internet access, as long as you have some access, you're fine. Why broadband in particular? Why do we need this high-speed access in more parts of the state?
Well, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. And the importance of broadband is something that I think we need to stress more. We need folks to recognize its value. Broadband is integral for business, for agriculture, manufacturing, economic development. Many folks have telecommuting options available for them. It's very important for education, K through 12. We want to avoid students having to drive to their local McDonald's to complete their homework assignments. It's really vital for telehealth and medicine and really just participating in today's modern economy. It's important to have vibrant, prosperous communities, and I think broadband is a key element of that.
Access is one part of the story. You know, do you have the infrastructure to get it to your house or business? How about affordability, though, especially if we're talking about maybe a lower income part of the state here?
Yes, affordability is another crucial issue that I think we're working forward to address. You know, the infrastructure might be there, but if it's not affordable and it's not attainable and accessible by businesses and residents, then it isn't really meeting its full intention. And if affordability is an issue that I think the state is focused on, the governor is focused on, our agency is focused on. We have a low-income internet discount finder tool that we have been publicizing and trying to increase its usage, and that's a good tool for folks to find internet low-income options in their area, but it's definitely an issue we're focused on and trying to address.
And Jaron, before we let you go, this $24 million competitive grant program, what has been the response? What's the demand like?
The demand has been large. So we have $24 million for this particular grant round in fiscal year 2020. We have seen over $50 million in requests. And that is really a consistent theme that is we've seen over the course of our grant program. But fortunately, we've seen the $24 million for this grant round, which is more than any previous grant round combined. So this extra funding is great, but the need is still out there.
Jaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
Jaron McCollum is the State Broadband Director within the Division of Digital Access, Consumer, and Environmental Affairs at the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin. We're talking about broadband access. Our next guest joins us for a look at the ways that communities around the country have tackled the broadband access question. Christopher Mitchell is Director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Christopher, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into some community solutions, can you talk about the need, the demand for high-speed internet access in currently underserved areas?
Yes, I think one of the things that we see is that most areas want, at the very least, better choices. But in the areas that don't have any internet access in terms of high-speed service, they've been waiting a long time. They really want it. I think it is true that we do need to do more work to make sure where it is available, people understand the full benefits of it and they adopt it and use it. But it's also hard for people to hear that when they know that they want it and they just can't get it where they are.
And some people will say, and I posed a question to our previous guest, something along these lines. Some people say, well, you know, if you don't have the broadband, you can get satellite. You've got your phone and it's got some kind of cellular connection. If you have reception, isn't that good enough?
No, it is not good enough. The problem with using your phone is that it's expensive and it's hard to have a modern education when you don't have that kind of internet access that I have here in my home in St. Paul or anyone has in most of the urban and suburban areas of Wisconsin. The satellite is just not good enough, and it's also quite expensive. It comes with these bandwidth caps that will slow you down or turn you off if you use it too much. And so, you know, there's this issue where some people will say, well, maybe you shouldn't live in a rural area. You know, I think the common response from people in more rural areas is where do you think your food comes from? But I actually think the most appropriate response is to look back and think about electrification. would we be better off today if in the 1930s we decided not to bring electricity to everyone? And the answer is every one of us living in urban areas would be worse off. We've all benefited from the productivity gains and benefits from establishing and the right effectively, although I don't like that language, but making sure that everyone can have access to essential infrastructure. We all do better over the longer term because the economy works better.
A lot of your work through the Community Networks Project is focused on getting communities internet networks that are reliable and can be held accountable by their users. What kind of approaches have you seen communities take around the country?
Well, a lot. There's a lot of different approaches because something like 25,000 local jurisdictions, a lot of them have different ideas about how to make this work. You know, as Jaron McCollum was saying, in Wisconsin, you have a lot of local companies, sometimes local telephone cooperatives, sometimes local electric cooperatives that are stepping up. And so if a community has those available, they'll often work with those. If they have a local independent telephone company that's a privately owned company but is rooted in the community, maybe they can work with them. In places in which they're mostly served by larger companies that are located out of state, like Frontier, which is headquartered in New England, or CenturyLink, which is headquartered in Louisiana, those companies are prioritizing investments in major urban areas. And so for those areas, we might see communities thinking about building their own network. Wisconsin law actually makes it a little bit more difficult, but Reedsburg, Wisconsin is a wonderful example. And in other cases, we may see more cities or counties actually trying to work with a co-op that's maybe 30 miles away and trying to figure out what you could do to have them expand there. And I think that the Wisconsin broadband grants through the Public Service Commission have helped that, and I think we'll see more of that in the future.
Yeah, you've got a map up showing where there are these unique community solutions to providing broadband. There's not a lot of dots here in Wisconsin. Reedsburg in the surrounding area, I saw some, and a couple others. Why don't we see as much of this in Wisconsin as we do even just next door in Minnesota?
Well, there's a lot of different reasons that do go into it, but one of them is that the telephone companies and the big cable companies were successful in creating barriers. Wisconsin's one of 19 states that have barriers to cities building their own networks. Now, Minnesota actually does too, and so do a number of other states that have a lot of connections, that have a lot of local networks. So that's not the only reason, but I think it's a pretty major one. And one of the things that I think we will see is Reedsburg probably expanding and helping some other communities out more. But I think we need to see communities taking more responsibility for this. You know, it's easy for me to come on this show and to say, well, the state should do this and the federal government should do that. That's all true. But local communities also need to step up. They need to take some risks in some cases. I mean, they need to be informed risks. But for communities that aren't willing to invest in themselves, even with the barriers they may face or the challenges, they may see their population continue to dwindle and move to areas where they have better local internet access.
We're talking about broadband access, especially for rural or underserved areas. Christopher Mitchell is with us, director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in one of the parts of the state where there is no access to high-speed internet? Do you lack any access or do you have limited options? Can you afford what you have? Is it reliable? Are you part of a community effort like the one in Reedsburg we were talking about to figure out your own solutions to providing this kind of high-speed internet access? Call 800-642-1234. And if you're in rural Wisconsin, how do these issues affect your quality of life, your quality of business? 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about broadband access with Christopher Mitchell. He's director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your experience been with internet access in your neighborhood? Is it reliable? Is there any available? Is it affordable? Why is broadband access important to you? If it is, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls. Don is with us in Door County. Don, hello.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the program. And I was hoping your guests would explain the legislative barriers to expansion in Wisconsin a little bit better. But my other question goes to, we're paying, let's see, four major telecoms, I believe it was 2017, received $642 million from the Federal Communications Commission. That comes off our universal service fee on our phone bills. So we're subsidizing some of the big telecoms already. If there was a change in, say, Door County had a became a provider for internet service, would they be eligible to apply for some of this federal communications money that the big telecoms, and it was aimed at expanding rural broadband in Wisconsin?
Don, thanks a lot for the call. Christopher, let's start with that second part. Could a local, say, co-op or whatever, say, in Door County, tap into that federal money that Don's pointing to that's aimed at boosting this kind of broadband access?
Yes, and I would expand that just briefly. There's two major pots of money that would be available. One that I think he's referencing comes from the Federal Communications Commission. They're going to have a massive auction toward the end of this year, and many local providers will be eligible for that. You do have to have a history in the business to be able to participate, so it's harder for someone to do it if they're new to the game. But if they want to have a partnership, that's an effort. And then the United States Department of Agriculture through the Rural Utility Service has a program that's been refunded almost every year, about $500 million that goes that's being spent through a program called ReConnect. And that's, again, generally tapped into by the cooperatives, but small providers could also tap into that. And those are programs that that I think are pretty well designed, as opposed to the programs that did not work as well that he referenced in the past.
And Don's other part of the question, if he went to his county board in Door County and they said, yeah, we're on board, we want to try to start something like this, what kind of hurdles would they have to jump through briefly?
Yes, the main one has to do with how you calculate. And the reason I didn't get into it is it's complicated and mind-numbing. But the key thing is the state's kind of micromanaging the business plan. And the concern was that the city or county might subsidize its service. And so they have to go through a bunch of accounting loopholes that would not necessarily be the case for another provider. And it can really put them in a straitjacket in terms of how they price their services and how they figure out how to get a return on what they're spending. And so what we like to see is cities that already have to stand for election. The local leaders already have to be accountable to the community. We don't think there should be special rules on cities and counties that aren't adhered to by the private providers that are already operating.
Thanks, Don, for the call. We'll go to Bill now in Green Bay. Bill, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. And as somebody who works in the IT industry, I think I can shed some light on a few of the other factors which are big players in getting broadband out to rural markets.
But tell us about them, Bill.
Well, to put it simply, and I guess brutally, how would you justify spending millions of dollars for a market or a township where there's only a few thousand people at most, and of those, a significant number are retirees who, or elderly outright, who may say, I'm not going to pay this amount of money for increased internet, which I barely use the internet, I might or might not even do email. That's a big factor right there.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call, Christopher. A lot of money to deliver a service to a small market, some of which Bill says doesn't even want the service.
Yes, I think that that's in a nutshell, the challenge, which is true also of electricity back in the day when it was being rolled out. And so the answer is that we use models that aren't looking to make a profit or are looking to return their investment over a longer time horizon. Even in those smaller areas, if you have a low interest loan over 20 or 30 years, it may be profitable. The problem for the private sector is that you don't want to return over 20 years, you want to return over 18 months. And so we can actually make business models that will work and that do not require ongoing subsidization. And that's typically where we turn to cooperatives to make that happen.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Kyle with us now in Delavan. Kyle, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a comment. I took some classes online, and I had to always sit outside of, you know, the hotel that had Wi-Fi or whatever because of where we're located. And I've noticed that with my nephew being in high school, everything is done online. And there is no internet access except satellite where my parents live. And what I find very disheartening, and I really like that we're subsidizing trying to help the rural areas, is to allow them, these rural kids, to have the same opportunity as the ones that live in the city, which is 5 miles from our house. We have great internet. My parents still don't.
Kyle, thanks for the call. That access to education Kyle is talking about, how big a part of the story is that, Christopher?
I think that's one of the biggest, because I mean, we have a lot of political divisions in this country, but one of the things that we pretty much all agree on is that kids should have a pretty equal opportunity to get ahead. And unfortunately, whether you're a low-income student in an urban area or someone living in a rural area without the ability to subscribe, we're asking those kids to do a lot of extra work. And one of the things that happens is something called the opportunity gap, which is that the well-off kids aren't just better off, they actually are increasingly better off because they can use the tools to get even further ahead than they were just because of which family they were born into. So I think this is it's a major concern.
Thanks for that call. We often talk about this as a rural story. Christopher, do you see issues and concerns in bigger cities when it comes to maybe not just the access, but the affordability?
Yes, I would say that the issue with the city is a little bit deceiving, because you may have in some areas competition, real competition between three or four providers in some parts of a city, and in another part of the city you might just have a cable monopoly where no one else is investing. And I think we're going to see major issues in cities in the coming decades still. This isn't something that will be resolved by 2030, I don't think. I think we may solve the rural broadband problem faster than we bring a real choice to everyone in cities.
Now, we heard on Facebook from Gail, who says 200 feet past her house, there's no cable for the remainder of her mile and a half road. The only options are either high-priced satellite internet or spotty cellular data. Are there a lot of places where it's that kind of last mile issue to get to more people? It's to the town, but not to the farmhouses a mile, 2 miles from town.
Yes, that is the major issue. Now, that's not the way most rural houses are, but there's some 1% or 2% in which it may cost $10,000 or more to bring a connection to that home. But we generally would balance that out against areas in which you might be connecting a place where there's several connections, within a half mile or something like that. And that's where I think we have to engage in more holistic thinking. And again, this is why I keep focusing on cooperatives or other community arrangements, because they'll take the areas that can generate more profits, and they will take the revenue from that to subsidize and balance out a person that's further away and requires a more extensive investment to get to.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Christopher, do you see this as a problem that maybe in fits and starts is being solved in this country?
It is being solved. I think it's being solved more by the local ingenuity, and particularly of co-ops in the Midwest, than government programs. I mean, Wisconsin, Minnesota putting tens of millions of dollars into this, it helps, and it's important. But we're talking about $1 billion, $2 billion need for investment in Wisconsin. So the federal government programs are okay. We're not seeing them taken seriously enough. Elected officials will talk about how important this is, but they're not passing legislation to produce accurate maps so that we'll know where the actual problem is. We're actually pretty blind to that at the macro scale. We have no idea what pricing is. No one's collecting that data and making it available. And so, I think we have a ways to go, but I take a lot of faith in the fact that the people who brought us telephone and electricity are taking this seriously, and they're quietly making investments around the country.
Christopher, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Christopher Mitchell, director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, looking at efforts to boost access to high-speed internet. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll check out tomorrow's State of the Tribes address in the state capitol and the big issues facing tribal groups around Wisconsin. And we'll follow the mystery of what happened to synthesizers that a Wisconsin composer used to create great NPR tunes. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, Kate's guest says we need to start teaching kids and grown-ups about climate change and how to adapt to a changing climate now and into the future. That's tomorrow at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then if you spent time on farms in rural areas just a few decades ago, you may have heard birds like meadowlarks and bobolinks often. Today, those songs are much more rare. We'll talk to the author of a new book that looks at how farming and wildlife shared the land in past generations and how we can recover some of that balance with different practices and policies. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.